Today, The Guardian investigation, which has exposed how Isabel dos Santos, Africa's first female billionaire, amassed a huge fortune. And why, after 3,000 years, are California's sequoia trees dying?
Hi, Jonathan. Thank you for having me. And I want to thank also London Business School for inviting me here. Say hello to everybody.
The voice you can hear belongs to Isabel dos Santos, Africa's richest woman. Forbes have estimated her to be worth $2.2 billion.
Commodity prices are down. So what do we do?
Dos Santos comes from one of Africa's poorest countries, Angola, a former Portuguese colony that was ruled over by her father, José Eduardo dos Santos, for nearly 40 years.
So yeah, she describes herself as an entrepreneur, but at home she's known as the princess.
There have long been questions about how she acquired her wealth. The billionaire has always claimed to be a self-made businesswoman. But this week, a cache of documents investigated by The Guardian and other news organisations appear to tell a different story.
What the leaks show us is the extent to which Dos Santos amassed a large fortune at vast cost to the Angolan state.
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, how has Isabel dos Santos really made her money? Juliet Garside is investigations correspondent for The Guardian.
Isabel dos Santos was born in 1973, just before Angola gained independence from Portugal. Her father, José Eduardo dos Santos, took over the leadership of the MPLA political party just after independence and just before the beginning of the civil war in Angola, which lasted for over a quarter of a century.
That civil war destroyed the country, and by the time Dos Santos' Communist Party, the MPLA, secured victory in 2002, more than 500,000 people had died and over 1 million had been displaced within Angola. It also devastated the country's infrastructure and the economy. What did José Eduardo dos Santos do next?
So the MPLA's method of retaining power was essentially to create an oligarchy, a powerful group of families with political and military connections, and to distribute large chunks of the country's wealth amongst them. So they set about nationalising key industries, everything, of course, from oil and diamonds to cement. In theory, there's lots of potential wealth to go around, but it isn't distributed. And in fact, a very large percentage of the population live below the UN definition of poverty, which is an income of $2 a day.
For the majority of Angolans, I can say the better period was the end of the war, because that meant people were no longer dying of bullets and being blown apart by missiles and so forth.
Rafael Marquez was born in Angola in 1971 and lived through the civil war. Now he's a journalist who's been reporting on corruption through his website, Macarangola.
But that meant also that they started dying more of corruption, because the resources that were needed for the hospitals, that were needed for the infrastructures, were just siphoned away. And that meant, for instance, bad roads killed many people in this country. It was a life of much suffering. And I remember vividly the days of communism in which we had to queue for bread, for food, for shoes, for anything. Basically, there was no distinction between the public purse and the private purse of the Dos Santos family.
Were people angry that money wasn't being spent on them?
People were angry. People were aware of what was happening. And there was repression in the country. We must bear in mind that Isabel dos Santos' father was a dictator.
And that word, dictator, was what you used to describe José Eduardo dos Santos in 1999. And that landed you in prison.
In prison, beaten up, convicted.
While her father is president, Isabel lives a very privileged life and much of it spent in the UK. She studies electrical engineering at King's College London. But what does she do next?
After graduating, Dos Santos began her career at Coopers & Lybrand, which went on to become PricewaterhouseCoopers, or PwC as we call it. After that, she decides to go back to Angola. Her first venture is a nightclub and restaurant in Luanda, the Angolan capital, and it's called the Miami Beach Club. It turned out to be a very savvy investment, and the club is now one of the most fashionable locations on the West African coast. And then in 2002, the year peace breaks out, she marries the Congolese businessman Cindy Kadokolo, and he's a high-profile collector in the art world, and they're a very, very glamorous couple. By her 40th birthday, Dos Santos owned really significant stakes in Angola's key industries. With her husband, they controlled companies in banking, cement, diamonds, telecoms. And then that expands in 2009 to include stakes in Portuguese banks and media companies.
So Dos Santos is building up this huge wealth. She's become incredibly successful. But when does she become internationally well known?
It's in 2013, really, when Forbes brings out its annual rich list and they do a big feature on her. And essentially what the feature explains is that she's become very rich with a lot of help from Dad, who at that time, of course, was president. So they've done this investigation into how she got her money. And I think the headline is Daddy's Girl, how an African princess banked $3 billion in a country living on $2 a day. Dos Santos has always emphatically denied she had any help from her father, and she's always denied receiving any state funds. She's always said that politics was her dad's business and business was hers.
Juliet, when we spoke to Raphael, who co-wrote this piece, he said it fell on deaf ears in Angola.
What was most difficult for me was not to find the information, was to see it being ignored.
And for Dos Santos, everything proceeded business as usual. How significant was his article from an international perspective?
I think it was landmark, actually. I think that it became a reference piece about her, that anybody who did business with her from that point on understood what they were taking on.
So the Forbes piece didn't make much impact in Angola. What happened in the following years?
So her father steps down in September 2017, but in the two, three years before that, he starts using presidential decrees to award contracts to consortia that involve foreign contractors like the Chinese and the Dutch, big building projects, and those contracts have teamed up with her companies. And those contracts are worth billions of dollars between them. So the brazenness with which she secured government contracts in Angola, it just became more and more extreme.
And we know all of this because it was reported at the time, but it still didn't seem to affect Dos Santos or her family. One thing that did change was the leadership of Angola. After Eduardo Dos Santos stepped down, he was succeeded by a man from his own party, the former defence minister, Juan Lourenço. What difference did this change of regime in 2017 make to Isabel Dos Santos?
Well, the new president comes out very strongly saying he wants to fight the cancer of corruption. He announces an amnesty, saying that all the Angolans who've salted money away abroad can bring it back without prosecution. And he begins to take on some very high-profile people, not least of which, in the summer of 2018, Isabel Dos Santos. We've been told she received a request in July 2018 to come and talk to prosecutors, and that she left the country on that day. She denies ever having received a request.
In 2019, Juliet, is when you start working on this story. Last summer, The Guardian and a network of other news organisations received a leak of 700,000 documents relating to Dos Santos. How did you get hold of them?
So last summer, we started looking at the data, and it was shared with us by an organisation in Washington called the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, so ICIJ. And they obtained this data from another group, a whistleblower group, who themselves had received it from a whistleblower who was concerned about what it showed about the way that she'd done business.
What did they show?
What the documents appear to reveal is how Africa's richest woman made her fortune through exploiting her own country. She got access to lucrative deals involving land and oil, diamonds and telecoms. And as we know, Angola is very rich in oil and very rich in diamonds. It's Africa's second largest oil exporter. The documents show how she and her husband were allowed to buy valuable state assets in a series of what we think are suspicious deals. Dos Santos has long denied that her fortune is the result of nepotism, but our investigation suggests that, in fact, she did benefit from extraordinary opportunities and that they were afforded to her by the government of her father.
So we're going to go through some of the deals that helped Isabel Dos Santos build her business empire. Let's start with Angola's largest industry, oil. She gets involved in the state-owned oil company Sonangol. What does she do?
So as she tells it, in 2015, Sonangol is in crisis. The government has created a committee to oversee reforms and a restructuring of the company. And her own business is brought in as an external advisor. In fact, she has no background really in oil and gas, but she says that she was selected for her extensive business experience. And she produces a report with the help of some management consultants about how to sort out Sonangol. And then she says the government really couldn't think, this commission couldn't think of anyone better to actually implement the recommendations in the report. So they asked her to come and join the company as chair. And so at that point, she gets the keys to essentially the Angolan economy. I mean, the most central company in the Angolan economy, 90% of exports. And over the next 18 months, so from June 2016, she does a lot of work with lots of different consultants. And in order to pay them, Sonangol makes transfers of about $115 million. And we know from the data, and she does accept this, that the money was routed to Dubai, to a company that in fact is controlled by her friend and two of her associates. Her father resigns in September 2017, and very shortly afterwards, the new government decides to let her go. On the 15th of November, she's sacked. In the hours and days before that happens, we see her authorising $58 million in payments out of a bank account in Portugal belonging to the state oil company, Sonangol. And that bank account is actually in her own private bank. And we see that bank account is emptied and the money all goes out to this Dubai company managed by her friend on the 16th of November, the day after her sacking. We should add that Dos Santos and her associates have denied all wrongdoing. She says that the money was paid for real work done by real management consultants. And she denies that the transfers were in any way intended to empty Sonangol's bank account before she was forced from office.
God, it is just completely extraordinary. And in this leak, you also saw documents that showed how her husband, Sindika Dokolo, had been involved in the Angolan diamond industry. What did you find?
So we found that in 2012, Sindika had acquired a stake in a Swiss jewellery house called De Grisogono. It was even at the time one of the world's most prestigious jewellery makers. Documents that we saw suggest that the Angolan-backed diamond company, which was called Sodiam, was absolutely key to buying and financing De Grisogono. And that in doing this deal, in helping on this deal, it exposed itself to huge loans to pay for the purchase of the company and to pay for its ongoing support and meet the losses. So despite its financial investment, it appears that Sodiam took no role in deciding how De Grisogono was run. So basically, Sindika Dokolo and his team appear to have managed the loss-making business themselves. And Dos Santos, in fact, although she had no ownership, was sorting out a new premises in London, a new shop in London, doing the design. Again, the couple have denied all the claims. Dokolo's lawyers said both partners had invested the same sums into the company, both he and Sodiam. He claims, in fact, that he's invested $115 million and that that's been verified as well through an independent audit. And in December, he launched legal action against Sodiam, and he did it at a London arbitration tribunal where he claimed that he'd lost money in the venture.
Finally, another business venture that the leaked documents shed light on is a multi-billion dollar real estate and highway development along the coastline of Luanda, which is the capital city. Now, that project ended up being cancelled by the new president, but not before 3,000 families had been evicted from the site. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Well, first of all, we should say that there is no evidence that Dos Santos ordered the eviction. And there's no consensus on what project that eviction was ordered for. But what the documents have very clearly shown is that it was only her company and its partners that did stand to benefit from the redevelopment of this vacated land. She disputes this. She says her redevelopment plans did not require evictions. And she also insists that she was not financed by any state money. But I have to say, what's really struck me about her response is that she hasn't taken this opportunity at any stage to express any concern about the lives being lived by the people who used to be on Area Branca. And we know that some of these 3,000 families are now living in appalling conditions, that they were dumped on the streets of Luanda and not offered housing, and that they've taken refuge, many of them, 500 of them now have taken refuge in a patch of land that used to be a rubbish dump through which there are open sewers flowing. In fact, my colleague, Jason Burke, who went and interviewed the people of this place, Povoado, says the conditions there are some of the worst he's ever seen.
So you gathered all of this information, and then just before you were about to publish, the authorities in Angola began taking action to try and stop Dos Santos and her husband. Tell me what happened.
So it was over Christmas, and we'd all sent out our letters to her and to various people explaining what we'd found in the data and fronting up and saying, how would you answer these allegations? One of those letters I'd sent to the ex-president's office, and it had leaked. So the Attorney General announces an asset freeze, and basically it's a list of everything she has in Angola, all the businesses and bank accounts.
Okay, so her assets are frozen in Angola, but now that you've published your story, what else has happened to her?
I think her world has changed very rapidly. First of all, she was banned from being a customer of her own bank. This is a Portuguese private bank called Eurobic, in which she's the largest shareholder. Then very soon after that, Eurobic announced that she was going to sell her shares and exit the bank as a shareholder. On Wednesday evening, the Attorney General of Angola formally announced that she was a suspect in a criminal investigation into the misappropriation and mismanagement of funds during her time at Sonangol.
Isabel Dos Santos has responded to these allegations, including in a BBC interview.
One has to be judged by one's own merits. And
your father played no role. And the state
in my
has no role in your success.
In my business? No.
What has she said?
She says she is the victim of a politically motivated witch hunt, which is designed to take her out as a potential political opponent to the current president. She says that everything she did was legal, that she never took any state money. And her husband says the same thing. They say they pay a lot of tax in Angola and other European countries, and that they're great for the Angolan economy because they've started a lot of businesses there and they employ a lot of people.
We've received copies of these invoices.
I will not be familiar with the invoices.
Here,
themselves.
For instance, for 472,000 euros.
She was presented with the invoices, that some of those that you must have looked over, but she still continues to deny it.
All the services rendered under the contract are known services, and they were delivered and rendered. And all the invoices.
Do you think she wholeheartedly believes that she has made her $2.2 billion fortune honestly?
Yeah, I get the feeling she feels it was all legitimately spent and well spent money, and that it was anything that she got from the state was on merit.
Could there be any truth to her saying that this is politically motivated by the current Angolan president, Juan Lourenço?
There has been some criticism that the corruption drive is too narrowly focused on a small number of people in a move to perhaps consolidate the power base of the current president.
Because for context, you know, this does probably go further than just the Dos Santos family. I mean, in 2012, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, produced a report where they found this $32 billion hole in Angola's state accounts. This is this is quite a lot bigger, isn't it, than just the former president's family?
It's a lot bigger, and it is estimated that billions are still being held in offshore bank accounts and outside Angola by the elite that looted the country.
This story doesn't just have ramifications for Dos Santos and her husband, but also the companies who worked with her. Who is involved, and have there been any repercussions for them?
Yes, there certainly have. There were, in fact, many companies outside Angola who were connected to her businesses, in particular quite a few management consultants and accounting firms, and none more so, it seems, than PwC, where she used to work. PwC helped across the Dos Santos empire, so both her companies and her husband's. They did auditing, consultancy, tax advice, we think for at least 20 different companies. Speaking at the big gathering of business and political leaders at Davos this week, PwC's global chairman, Bob Moritz, said that he was shocked and disappointed.
I will say personally from the top of the house, I'm disappointed. Disappointed from the perspective that we didn't identify this earlier and disappointed that we didn't exit earlier.
And that an internal investigation had been launched. And we know also that PwC is terminating all its relationships with her companies and those of her husband. And also, shortly after those comments, the head of PwC's Lisbon tax team stepped down and he's now left the company. But there have also been some much more tragic consequences. It was confirmed on Thursday morning that a director of Eurobic, who had worked extensively alongside her as a private banker, had been found dead at his home in Lisbon. The police suspect suicide.
Isabel dos Santos has made London her home for years, as so many people with huge amounts of wealth do. Is there an extent to which they are protected here?
I've come into the studio two or three times after doing investigations like this and made the point that, you know, we have so many of these kind of people. We have so much of this dark money in London. People come here because they want access to our banking system, our courts, so that they can have disputes about who owns what. And they want access, you know, to the lifestyle and the rule of law. It's not that we tolerate it. I think we do more than that. I think we're pretty much open for business when it comes to this sort of money coming into the UK.
Raphael, do you believe that the West has protected Isabel dos Santos to a degree?
Did not only protected her, promoted her, actively promoted her. That's what is kind of depressing, being an African, you know. It must be the West to take the lead, even when we are addressing our own problems and saying, this person is a crook and here is the evidence.
The Angolan government says it will use all possible means to force Isabel dos Santos to return to Angola. What do you think should happen to her now?
I would like to see her in court. And answer in court, be accountable in a court of law. And that day will be a day that every Angolan will feel that justice is on the right course when Isabel faces trial and her father faces trial and the most corrupt officials in this country queue up, as we queued up to buy bread, they queue up to face justice.
That was Rafael Marquez. Find more of his work at macaangola.org. You can read the full Luanda Leak story at theguardian.com, which has been put together by Juliet, David Pegg and Hilary Osborne from our amazing investigations team, with reporting from Jason Burke, our Africa correspondent. Coming up, the climate crisis reaches California's sequoia trees. Now, California's giant sequoia trees are one of the natural wonders of the world, But to the shock and dismay of conservationists and rangers, the last 3 years has seen the trees dying off like never before. The Guardian's biodiversity and environment writer, Patrick Greenfield, travelled to California to find out why this was happening.
Seeing a giant sequoia tree for the first time is a semi-religious experience. They are enormous. You kind of look up at the top and you can't quite see where the tree ends. I mean, they can grow up to 90 metres tall, and it's not the tallest tree, but they are so wide. You need 20 people linking arms to go around the base of the tree. There's a reason why these trees are so iconic for America. Since 2016, 28 giant sequoias have died in a way that has never previously been recorded in human history. Giant sequoias, when they die, they normally topple over after 2,000 years, 3,000 years in their own weight. But these trees are now dying standing from what appears to be a deadly interaction between bark beetles, stress on the trees from drought, which has been a massive theme for the last few years in California, and also very intense fires. Almost all of these trees have almost 100% fire damage at the base. And the researchers who study these beautiful trees are saying this is yet another effect of the climate crisis. I spoke to people who have been studying these amazing forests for over 3 decades. And I guess with the climate crisis, we don't often think about the emotional impact this research has on scientists themselves. And that was evident with Christy Bingham, who showed me around the forests in Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. And this was her reaction when she saw Lazarus, one of these monarch giant sequoia trees that had been standing for 2,000 years and has died because of these beetle attacks.
It's hard to see these trees that are dead without feeling emotional about it. I mean, this is a tree that's lived through 2,000 years of fire, other droughts, wet years, dry years, hot years, cold years. It's been here longer than Europeans have been in this country. And it's dead. And it shouldn't be dead. Like, this is not how giant sequoias die.
With climate crisis, we will expect more droughts, more stress on trees, more fire damage, more beetle attacks, more deaths. But what can we do about it? The strange answer, really, is actually more fire. Fire is vital to the health of giant sequoia trees. Now, I'm not talking about the intense type of wildfires we've seen across California. I'm talking about these natural, slow-burning fires that work their way through the forest for 3 months and clear the floor. It's how everything decomposes there. It's not like a wet Northern Hemisphere forest. And giant sequoias actually can't reproduce without fire, but fires have not burnt there for over 100 years because of humans, and it's bad for the health of the trees. Fire is a very controversial topic in California. It's very difficult for people who work in the National Park Service to argue that they have to clear hundreds of hectares of woodland with a slow-burning fire while people are dying a few miles away and having their homes destroyed. And I guess Americans might have to get used to the fact that some of California's national parks might become smokier and for tourists not as nice to visit some times of the year. But actually moving forward, maybe that's how life needs to be for the long-term health of these forests. Although we're only talking about 28 giant sequoia trees, this is a pretty loud and scary warning shot in the climate crisis. When you say, oh, they're 1, 2, 3 millennia old, what does that mean? They have survived the life and birth of Jesus Christ, the Prophet Muhammad, every empire, caliphate, kingdom, presidential inauguration you can think of. They have been there, they have survived it. And it's the last few years where something's changed. These are trees that are fabled for their indestructibility, and they're dying. The story of the climate crisis is almost relentless bad news, but we need something that's going to wake us up. And maybe what's happening to the giant sequoia trees will do just that.
That was Patrick Greenfield. You can read his full piece at theguardian.com. Thanks to him and Juliet Garside. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Have a lovely weekend. We'll be back on Monday.